Hey everybody, Brian McClanahan here. Are you looking for a great website that gives you history the way it was intended to be told, with no PC, no Marxism, no progressivism? Well, I've got it for you. It's learntruehistory.com. That's learntruehistory.com. Learn history from great professors who don't sugarcoat it for you. This is not for your delicate flowers. That's learntruehistory.com. learntruehistory.com. This is the Brian McClanahan Show.
3, 2, 1, 0, liftoff.
Welcome back to the Brian McClanahan Show. This is episode 61. Glad to have you back on the program. Before we get started, just want to remind everyone to like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and like my YouTube page. And please, if you like this podcast, spread the word. Share it on social media, share it with your friends, share it with your family, share it with your enemies. Anyone who you think would benefit from this podcast, please share it around. Okay, so today I want to talk about an issue that I've touched on before, but not in this particular way. In fact, I've done several different angles on this particular issue, and that is the issue of secession, self-determination, local self-government, think locally, act locally, all those things that I've talked about on this podcast. And I want to attack it from a different angle. And this issue can't get out of the news right now because California has made, or at least a large faction of California, has made it aware, or made it known, that they want to secede from the Union. And so even mainstream people are starting to talk about this. You know, Victor Davis Hanson had a piece on it, negative piece on it, not long ago. And I responded to that in townhall.com. This Hanson piece originally appeared in National Review, and then it was published on Town Hall as well. And then Pat Buchanan, just a couple of days ago, ran a piece on it, essentially supporting it. Look, why can't, and he concluded by saying, why can't California be California, and why can't Red State America be Red State America? So there's a couple of things I want to talk about with that, and then I want to do a little academic exercise with this particular issue. So first and foremost, we need to remember a few things about this idea of self-determination and secession. Number one, this has to be a cultural, not a political movement. What I mean by that is this: you can't have self-determination unless you have a cohesive and homogenous culture that wants to withdraw from something. It's not enough just to say, look, you know, I'm tired of this particular thing, so I want out. Well, who's going to go with you? And what are they going to be like? And so that culture can be a political culture, as you have perhaps in California, where you have a large faction of Marxists, essentially, who want out. It could be a religious culture, something of that nature, but it has to be cohesive and it has to have culture. This has to be a cultural, not a political revolution in that particular way. People have to decide that their culture is being threatened by an outside source in order to make this work. And so you have to build these communities. This is what Think Locally, Act Locally is all about. You have to build communities, and these communities have to be fairly self-sufficient, or it won't work. And I am not certain that, you know, this is even possible at this point in American history. We have a large dependent community, and just about every state is dependent on the general government. Just about every person in America, in some way or another, is dependent on the general government. So you have to break that dependence. And there are ways to do that. I mean, there's personal secession I've talked about. You can homeschool. You can get off the system in whatever way possible. You can become independent. And that is, when you look at self-determination in American history, you find that. You know, you look at the people that seceded from the British Empire in 1776. They were independent people. They didn't really need the British Empire. You look at the men that wanted to secede throughout American history before 1861, these were fairly independent people. And then when secession finally happened in 1860 and 61, those were independent people as well. And so that independence becomes very important. How are you going to survive on your own without the federal trough? And so this is why I've said, look, states need to get off the federal trough. They need to start rejecting federal dollars and saying we can do this on our own. Yeah, you're going to see higher taxes. It's going to happen within your own state government. If you want the same type of services and products that you would get from the general government, you're going to have them from the state government, and so your state taxes are going to go up. So you're going to have some level of civic independence, but you're also going to have some level of personal independence. It's impossible to even think about a self-determination movement without that. And so the other thing you can do is build strong cultural and political communities on like-minded people. You know, when you hire somebody to do some work in your house, if you need to do that, hire someone that thinks like you. If you hire someone to do a job, some other kind of job, hire someone that thinks like you. Start building networks of people, of like-minded people, and therefore you can have some cultural continuity and political continuity, and you can rely on each other. Be good to each other in these communities. Help each other out. Build strong, faith-based communities that rely on interdependence in that way with each other. I mean, people are social creatures, so they do need to have some type of community environment. If you can do those things, then self-determination becomes a little more straightforward, a little more easy to accomplish. And like I talked about in the last podcast about local self-government, I mean, you have to think about that too. When I mentioned the Doomsday Book, when that Doomsday Book, that census was being written, a large town might have had 2,000 people in it. A large town, 2,000 people. So we've tended to think that larger is always better, but that's not necessarily true. Maybe smaller is better. You have more control. And so when I said I wanted to get into an academic exercise today, I'm actually going to focus on the 1777 essay by David Hume entitled The Ideal Commonwealth. Now, this essay was not published until after his death. Hume died in 1776, and so this essay, which published the year after, was found in his manuscripts. And he had written this thing, as again, as an academic exercise. Now, one of my friends is one of the best Hume scholars, I think, in the world, and that would be Donald Livingston. He's written several books on David Hume, and he was the first person who I ran into that talked about this essay. He talked about it in a conference about 7 years ago in this Ideal Commonwealth. And so this is not something that is unusual to have an academic exercise. What would be the ideal state if you had one? How would that be structured? I remember when I was an undergraduate and taking political science courses, the entire political science department was dominated by Marxists. But they often talked about different ideal governments. They really didn't care for the U.S. Constitution, go figure, because it didn't have enough centralized power, at least in their own mind. We've seen what happened with the U.S. Constitution over time. It does have a lot of centralized power, not because that's legal, just because people have done it. And in that way, I think this is one area where I can begrudgingly respect Alexander Hamilton, because he said in June of 1787, look, why don't we just skip all the nonsense that we're going to have to go through to get to the end game and just go to the end game? And that end game would be an elected king, a government with unlimited power, a central government with unlimited power. We'll just skip over all this stuff. The states are just going to be obstacles. We'll just make them corporations, and we'll go into this central authority that everyone's going to want anyways. We're going to want an executive with unlimited power. We'll just get there. Now, when he made the speech in the Philadelphia Convention in 1787, no one bought it. In fact, they mocked it, because these men in 1787 were real Republicans. And what I mean by that is they favored Republican government. They favored a limited Republican government. And Hamilton's proposal wasn't going to fly. Not with these guys. Not with the guys that had just broken away from the British Empire. But today, if you made this speech, Americans might be shocked about it, because we've been so preconditioned to say, no, we don't want a king. But we have one. We have an elected king in America. So what's the difference? I mean, this is where Hamilton was prescient, saying you're going to have it anyways. Might as well just call a spade a spade. call a tomato a tomato. Say what it is. We're going to have an elected king, and that's what we've got. So people have these academic exercises all the time, and these Marxists would say, you know what, the American system, political system, needs to be more parliamentary. We need to have a parliament, not a Congress. We need to have the executive within the legislative branch, not outside the legislative branch, because that kind of government works better. And we need to have more democracy, more direct democracy techniques. We need to have a situation where people have more control, or at least more input into the government. And in some ways, I mean, you can see their point. The general population does not have any real influence in the general government. And that's because you have a representative ratio of about 735,000 to 1 for the U.S. Congress and the House of Representatives. And, of course, you know, the states used to have control over the U.S. senators. They don't anymore. So now you have these popular campaigns for U.S. Senate where outside money can come in and influence who's going to represent your state. The Senate was supposed to represent the states. This was said over and over again during ratification of the Constitution. The Senate represents the states, not individual people. So we have a system that is broken for the central authority if we want the central authority to do everything that it does. Now, if it didn't do that, if we had a central authority that handled only general concerns, which would be commerce and defense, and all other issues were left to the states, well, then it wouldn't really matter about a representative ratio at 735,000 to 1. In reality, I mean, we could say that that's not good representative government because it's not. But if all they were doing was deciding things like foreign policy and what type of trade policies we're going to have with other countries, well, then, and you don't really need the representatives to be that in tune with what's going on within the states themselves. You just need to know, okay, we want to have good trade policy with foreign countries, and we want to be, and what kind of foreign policy we're going to have. Now, we can debate what kind of foreign policy we should have, and of course, I'm going to come down on a non-interventionist, peaceful relationship, peaceful footing with other countries, but we can talk about that particular issue when we have general elections. And in that way, the president would be almost irrelevant because the president simply executes the laws of Congress, which would be trade and foreign policy, and the president can help set foreign policy as well. He's chief diplomat. But outside of that, there's not a whole lot the president's going to do, not a whole lot the Congress is going to do. So if that's the kind of Congress we had, then, I mean, great, but we don't have that. We have a Congress that wants to legislate for every issue under the sun. And the American people, if there is such a thing, the people of the states, seem to want this. I think only because they've been conditioned to think that way. Every issue is now a national issue, and that's not the way the system was designed. But what happens if we had a different type of political system? What would be the ideal political system? Well, of course, I'm going to say we need to be more decentralized. And this is not something that's new. People, and there's a bunch of kooky people running around out there saying that everything I'm talking about here is radical. This is radical. Are you serious? You're talking about decentralization? That's radical. No one's ever talked about that before. You must have made this up. You must have made this up, just last week. No one's ever said this before. You're a radical. And I know people think that. I mean, I guess they're going to call Pat Buchanan a radical. Or are they going to call these California leftist radicals? I mean, they're on the same side. Usually the people that are out there running around saying these people are radicals, they're all on the left. So when the left starts advocating secession, is it then radical? Or when the left starts talking about we need a different type of political system, this one's broken, you have many left-wing groups that talk about that. You have many groups on the right that talk about that. Maybe that's because the system is fairly unworkable at this point, and the people don't really have much influence in it, on the left or the right. Americans are angry, as I've said in this podcast, because we have a national top-down system approach to every single problem under the sun. So, what I'm going to talk about is from the pen of David Hume. Now, David Hume is a very famous enlightened philosopher. Scottish. He is someone who was skeptical of religion, so a lot of people on the left have liked David Hume. What Dr. Livingston, Donald Livingston, talked about with David Hume is more his history of Great Britain, and not just that, his political philosophy. So this, again, is an academic exercise. What kind of ideal state could we have if we were able to change the structure, so to speak? And Hume's idea of the ideal commonwealth is quite interesting. Basically, what he says is, okay, what we need to do is decentralize this thing to a point where you cannot have any corruption. And how are you going to do that? Well, you're going to divide, he says, let Great Britain and Ireland, or any territory of equal extent. So essentially, we're looking at a state. You couldn't do this for the United States, not in this design. You'd have to break it out. So I think one thing you could say is, all right, look, here's what we're going to do. We're going to limit that central authority to only these things. They can only handle commerce and defense. And then we're going to do this. We're going to have these ideal commonwealths in the states. And here's why. When the U.S. Constitution was written, there was a proposal put forward again to have a census every 10 years. And the first census was taken in 1790. This is actually mandatory. They have to do this. First census in 1790 because they have to look at reapportionment. So in that census, there were about a little over 4 million people in the entire United States. 4 million people. Well, today, many states have that many people. So George Washington was worried about representative ratio at 40,000 to 1. He said it should be 30,000 to 1 because you can't have good representative government. Now, the argument was made, of course, we're only going to have general government for general concern, so we don't really need lower representative ratio. And some states wanted that. You know, New England, they balked at having a representative ratio so high. And also they balked at biannual elections. They wanted annual elections. So they wanted to have more democratic control. But it was argued you don't need that when you have a situation where you have a general government for general concern. So if you could just leave that alone, say, okay, all you're going to do is commerce and defense. But in these states, which now have 4 million people, we're going to break this thing down even further. So he said you need to divide each state into 100 counties, and each county into 100 parishes, making in all 10,000 representative units. Within each one of these counties, these 10,000 counties, each county would then elect, each parish in the county would elect a representative. Each parish would elect a representative, and then these 100 representatives would then go to a seat in the county, and they would elect a representative. So he says at the end of the day, you would get 100 senators, because you would have 100 counties, 1,100 county magistrates, these county magistrates would then elect a senator, and 10,000 county representatives. So you have very large representative bodies. But what you have done is decentralize the entire process to where you cannot have any influence of corruption. You can't have, for example, some special interest go out and try to influence every county. You just can't do it. And these senators are removable very quickly. They only get one-year terms, so they can be booted out of office. You can actually make it. He's going back to the Greek practice of ostracism. These people can be exiled if they're corrupt and they're not doing a good job. The executive powers are circumscribed and they're easily controllable by the people. So what he has done is created this ideal commonwealth that's very decentralized to prevent combination, to prevent corruption, to prevent special interests to come in and take over. That sounds pretty good. And again, it's kind of going back to the medieval model, the thing I talked about on the last podcast, local self-government. And he says it, look, if you have these small little counties and then these small parishes, I mean, you're basically talking about a situation where you have a couple thousand people in each parish, and they have a lot of control over their own destiny, their own government. Imagine if your neighborhood, your subdivision, was your government, and how much influence you could have over that government, and how much easier it would be to do business that way. You just knock on your neighbor's door and say, look, we got to talk about this issue. He also mentions a militia. There would be a rotating militia. Everyone would have to participate in this. So you would have a situation where the people would have the control over their own government, over war and peace. They would also have a situation where they would have skin in the game. In fact, the people that can vote are freeholders. He limits the vote to all freeholders of 20 pounds a year in the county and all the households worth 500 pounds in the town parishes. These are the people that meet to decide the elections. So there is, again, skin in the game. It's not just, you can't have dependents. There would be a limited franchise. You'd have people that have a certain income, and then you have people that have land with influence in the government. And I think that's the important part of this. You have to have skin in the game. We talk about this all the time. Why is it that one half of the people who don't really have much skin in the game can plunder the other half? In this particular case, that wouldn't happen. This is a marvelous essay, and I don't, in a short podcast like this, you know, 20 to 30 minutes, I don't really have time to go through the entire essay. But again, the point here being, what is the ideal state? How large should it be? How much influence should we have? What is the ideal community? What is the ideal political community? I know these are academic questions, but Hume does say something at the end of this essay that I find interesting because it's something the founding generation would have agreed with. He talks about if this could work and also if this could last indefinitely. So he says this: "We shall conclude the subject with observing the falsehood of the common opinion that no large state such as France or Great Britain could ever be modeled into a commonwealth, but that such a form of government can only take place in a city or small territory." So he's actually attacking Montesquieu here. A commonwealth, he's actually looking at a republic, is what he's talking about here. He's attacking Montesquieu. "The contrary seems probable. Though it is more difficult to form a republican government in an extensive territory than in a city, there is more felicity when once it is formed of preserving its steady and uniform without tumult and faction. It is not easy for the distant parts of a large state to combine in any plan of free government, but they easily conspire in the esteem and reverence for a single person, who by means of this popular favor may seize the power, and forcing the more obstinate to submit, may establish a monarchical government." So he's saying, yeah, big state, have more centralization. "On the other hand, a city readily concurs in the same notions of government. The natural equality of property favors liberty, and the nearness of habitation enables the citizens mutually to assist each other. Even under absolute princes, the subordinate government of cities is commonly republican, while that of counties and provinces is monarchical. But these same circumstances which facilitate the erection of commonwealths in cities render their constitution more frail and uncertain. Democracies are turbulent, for however the people may be separated or divided into small parties, either in their votes or elections, their near habitation in a city will always make the force of popular tides and currents very sensible. Aristocracies are better adapted for peace and order, and accordingly were most admired by ancient writers. But they are jealous and oppressive. And a large government, which is modeled with masterly skill, there is a compass and room enough to refine the democracy from the lower people who may be admitted into the first elections or first concoction of the commonwealth to the higher magistrates who direct all the movements. At the same time, the parts are so distant and remote that it is very difficult, either by intrigue, prejudice, or passion, to hurry them into any measures against the public interest." So he's saying you can organize a large state, which he would look at, say, the state of Alabama today as a large state. The United States, I mean, to have this in the United States, you'd have to have a monstrous commonwealth to make it work. And he's saying, look, I mean, you're going to combine into monarchy. He's saying what Alexander Hamilton said. You're going to get monarchy eventually. Skip over the nonsense and get to it. But he's saying that smaller units are naturally republican. They are, because you know the people. You know the people. You know your neighbors. You know the people down the street. You know those people. And it's easier to influence and have conversations with people you know. They may not be your best friends. You may not have barbecues together or watch ball games together or have long conversations about family and life. but you know them, and you can talk to them, and you can make your views known, and they can make theirs known, and you can make a situation that works best for the people in your community, for the best interests. And liberty is naturally pursued in this manner. And that's all Hume is saying. But he also says it's needless to inquire whether such a government would be immortal. He basically says no government's immortal. You can't know that. So we have this reverence for the U.S. Constitution in the United States as it's immortal. I mean, it can never be changed, never be altered. It's a civic worship. It's a civic religion. But even the founders thought it could be changed, and they actually advocated this when they were going through ratification. They said, look, if this thing doesn't work, amend it. Change it. Jefferson said, it's your duty to alter or abolish a government that does not meet your needs anymore, that becomes destructive of life, liberty, or property. You have a duty to alter or abolish that government. So these are men that thought it was very logical to change your government. They actually had constitutional conventions within their own states several times because things need to be changed. We just don't do this anymore because we have this idea that, we have a government, and it can't be changed or altered at all. It just has to be this. The United States is this to this, this coast to this coast, this size to this size. It can't be changed or altered at all. We can't do that. We can't break down even a state. You can't break it into smaller states. You can't do that because the state is this large to this large, this border to this border. You can't do anything like that. So in some ways, these are academic exercises because we're talking about, maybe things could be a little different. And all political philosophers, political scientists, do these kind of things. What would be better is to do this. There's nothing wrong with saying that. Would it be better to have a union of 49 states without California in it? Maybe California, with the eighth largest economy in the world, would be okay on its own. Maybe a political culture that it has would be okay on its own. I'm sure it would be. What is wrong with that? Would we not benefit from that? The red states would not benefit from not having California determine their policy. And at one point, we could get to a situation where the general government is run by California. Well, then, do we really have maybe California and New York? Do we really have representative government at that point? Well, we don't. And I think if we ever get to that point, you're going to start seeing a lot more people want out of this union. But maybe in that itself, these states are too large. Maybe we need to have smaller states in the states themselves. Maybe we need to have more bottom-up control. I've talked about nullification before on this podcast and how in the colonial period, in Virginia, for example, the county sheriffs could essentially nullify the law of Richmond. Well, we're just not going to follow it. That's nullification because it doesn't meet the political culture of that community. So these academic exercises, I think, are important for people to think about things outside the box. Could there be a better state that gives us more liberty, more Republican government, more democracy, if that's what you want? Could you have that? Certainly. And I think that's important as we move forward, to think about these things. Right now, the situation is what it is. Could a leftist state like California have a greater chance of self-determination than a conservative state? Absolutely. Is it going to happen? Probably not. But at least people are talking about, government could be more efficient this way, or we could have more liberty this way, or we could just have our socialist utopia this way. And these are things that are important. I think young people in particular, these are going to be issues of the 21st century. Without question, they're going to be issues of the 21st century because we've gotten to a point where the system is so large and so unresponsive, and we think the central government should do everything, and people are finally waking up. It can't. It physically can't. So you're going to start coming back into yourselves. And I hear it all the time. Think in this way, and you'll start realizing this is the real problem in America. Listening to Hawk Radio yesterday, there was a caller that called in and said, I've donated to the Republican Party so many times, and I've done this and this, and they just don't do anything. They don't do anything. Well, of course, you're looking to the center. Don't look to the center anymore. Look to your states and local communities. And if you start doing that, and they were organizing within their local communities, they were having Chamber of Commerce meetings, and they were having, they were putting together these coalitions of people, but they were still, we need to talk to our representative. We need to write a representative. No. Start looking to your state. Start looking to your local community. Just start doing the things yourself. And therefore, you can have more impact, more control over data, over your daily lives, because in reality, that is your daily life. Congress is not your daily life. Right here is. And if we can get that message out there, I think we're going to go a long way to creating happier people in America. I'll see you next time on The Brian McClain Show.